This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour today. It is our last episode of 2017, and our panel of trumpet writers have several big stories that they're anxious to tell you all about. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Greetings.
And joining us from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And from our office in the United Kingdom is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
On Trumpet Hour, we've been carefully following the situation in Jerusalem with U.S. President Donald Trump's decision early this month to formally recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and then his setting in motion of a plan to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to the fiercely contested Holy City. And this week, an unlikely player made the decision to follow America's lead. And then at the same time, one of America's primary adversaries defied America by announcing that Jerusalem is the everlasting capital, not of Israel, but of Palestine. So tensions in the Holy City are rising. And to bring us up to speed on this dynamic situation, we'll go to our man right there at Ground Zero in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it was very interesting. This past week we had the decision by the Guatemalan president that he was going to move his embassy to Jerusalem from now on, or very soon. This is President Jimmy Morales. And he, although his statement didn't really explicitly say that he recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital, it will be the case that Guatemala is going to follow the United States and move its embassy there. Now, while this might seem really strange for Guatemala to do this, Guatemala is a nation that has supported Israel for quite a long time. They were one of the first countries to recognize the State of Israel back in 1948. And even they led kind of the Latin American vote for that 48 vote for the partition of Palestine that would ensure that Israel would become a state. That was largely led by Guatemala. And right now, Mr. Morales, he is an evangelical. And so the evangelicals, both in the United States and around the world, really do believe in Israel's control over Jerusalem. And so he is backing this decision. Israeli diplomats right now are actively pursuing about 10 others or about 9 other nations, especially those that voted against the UN resolution that condemned the United States of its decision. Israeli diplomats are going after those states saying, hey, are you going to do the same thing too? Will you kind of, now that the United States has pushed the door open, does that give you a bit of courage to try and move your embassy and recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel as well?
What does Guatemala stand to gain from this? Or is it really just something that they feel is the right thing to do? So despite the fact that it might bring them at odds with most of the world, they just wanted to go ahead and recognize it.
Well, I think there are a number of things. They've been strong allies of Israel for a long time. The military partnership going back, I believe, to like 1971 has been really strong between Israel and Guatemala. A lot of Israelis actually helped train some of their forces. And so they do have a strong relationship, but it also, it does seem to be this being the will of the president himself to make this move. Now, it is interesting that at the same time as you have other nations maybe looking to move their embassy to West Jerusalem, most likely for Israel, you do have, as you said at the beginning, another nation, that being Iran, who passed a motion in its House of Representatives this week. I think it was 290 votes to zero, or 207, sorry, to zero, that recognized Jerusalem not as the capital of Israel, but as the everlasting capital of the Palestinians. Now, this is interesting because you're not going to see, or we haven't seen the nations of the world get upset by this. You haven't seen a UN resolution condemning this action. But basically, the Iranians have done the same thing that the Americans have done, except Palestine, or Jerusalem, isn't the capital of Palestine, at least how it works on the ground here. Clearly, Jerusalem's the capital of Israel, not a state that doesn't exist yet.
Do you have any idea what sort of support Iran would have from the other nations of the world for this assertion?
I think they might have actually started a trend, not necessarily that other nations would agree with them, because clearly the Iranians believe that Jerusalem is the capital, all of Jerusalem's capital, Palestine. The Israelis have no position there at all. The Jewish state shouldn't exist. That's their position. But I think what we're seeing now, what we are going to see as time goes on, is now that Mr. Trump has made this decision to say that Jerusalem's the capital of Israel, you're going to see other nations come out and say, okay, well, he said, well, we believe that it's the capital of Palestine as well. We know that the Turks have done that. We know that there's numbers of nations inside Europe that have said explicitly that we view Jerusalem as the capital of both states. Comments that haven't really gotten much attention, but through Mr. Trump's comments, through what he will affect on the ground, through the Guatemalans, through the Iranians, through the Turks, through the Europeans, we're kind of seeing Jerusalem in the discussion. But it's like there is going to be this de facto breakup of Jerusalem in world opinion. Now that Mr. Trump has opened the door, other nations are jumping on board saying, well, it's also the capital of the Palestinian state. And if you look at this decision by the Guatemalans, you have to ask, where is their embassy going to go? Their embassy is going to go in West Jerusalem. Anyone else that follows the suit of the United States, where's their embassy going to go? It's going to go in West Jerusalem. And so, yes, it's great to say that Jerusalem's the capital of Israel. But you note that Mr. Trump didn't say that all of Jerusalem's the capital of Israel. And as it stands on the ground, you're going to see a groundswell of embassies in West Jerusalem for Israel, and then a counter push for pro-Palestinian nations to put embassies inside East Jerusalem.
So from what you can tell there in Jerusalem, are these conflicting assertions and all these, you know, moving embassies, is that translating into any actual conflict there, or is this just a battle of rhetoric at this point?
No, it's not translating to conflict at all inside Jerusalem. Jerusalem's been quiet because the status on the ground is that Israel's in control, full control of all of Jerusalem. However, as time goes on, we are going to see, and this even what I'll talk about in the second half of the show, if the world does say to the Palestinians and move their embassies or create these embassies in a Palestinian state or inside Jerusalem, inside East Jerusalem for a Palestinian state, you might actually see the Palestinians rise up and support that international recognition in a violent means. And that's what we can see with, and that's why it's important to watch as time goes on, the Palestinians taking hold of this movement, and even Hamas trying to use the international community's backing of an East Jerusalem capital for the Palestinians as rationale for it to try and violently take over that part of the city.
Could you talk a little bit about how this is setting the stage for some of the Bible prophecies that we watch for at the trumpet to be fulfilled?
Yeah, well, the prophecy regarding Jerusalem is extremely important. It's found in Zechariah chapter 14. We talk about it often just because it's one of the key markers that shows us where we are in end time prophecy. And it basically states that Israel Jerusalem is going to be in the control of Israel, but then they're going to lose half of it violently. And so when we see nations that are dividing Jerusalem with their embassies already, the United States, its embassy right now, its consulate right now is right on the blue line. It's right on the border between East and West Jerusalem. Why don't they make that the embassy? They're not making it. They're going to build a different one in West Jerusalem. So because Bible prophecy says that we have the Palestinians that are going to control half of Jerusalem, the eastern side, any time where we see that happening internationally is very important, because it is the very first domino to fall that leads to important end time events. A book that or an article that people can read on this is entitled "Jerusalem is about to be cut in half." We'll leave it in the show notes for you to read, and that'll detail this prophecy explicitly for you.
And we also have an article up on thetrumpet.com by Mr. Brad McDonald. It's called Donald Trump Brings Bible Prophecy Alive in Jerusalem. It's actually the cover story of our latest print edition. And that's a very powerful piece that explains many Bible passages, including those that Brent mentioned there, just about what we can expect for the future of Jerusalem. And we'll be sure to have a link to that one as well in the show notes for today's episode. So please give that a look. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. Another trend that the Trumpet Hour keeps a close eye on is Europe increasing its influence over Latin America. These are sister continents, really, in terms of religion, language, and some other aspects of their culture. So it makes sense for the Europeans to exert quite a lot of influence over Latin America. And there have been some significant developments in this relationship in the last couple of weeks in the areas of trade and infrastructure. For this story, we'll go to our man in Europe, Richard Palmer.
Yes, this really has been a year of trade deals for Europe. They've been working to form some of these trade relationships around the world. One of the most high profile has been Japan, and that's been just finalized within the last few weeks. But then another major area that they're really pushing to build these trade deals is Latin America. And they're having a success this year and within the last few weeks that they have lacked for a long, long time. They've been wanting to do some of these trade deals for years. I remember some of the very first articles that I was working on when I was writing in the department back in, say, 2007, 2008, were about these trade deals between Europe and Mercosur, this kind of free trade area in Latin America, almost this Latin American European Union, you could almost put it that way. Mm-hmm. And back then, they were drawing closer to trade deals, but Latin America, they weren't willing to finalize it, to take it all the way. And they kind of got closer and closer, and they could never quite finish it. Now, this year, they've made some important steps on that. They hope to finish it by the end of the year. That was their aim. They began this year planning on doing that. They had a series of trade talks recently where they wanted to get it finished before the end of the year. They didn't quite make it. However, the roadblocks are different this time. It's not necessarily it's not kind of this fundamental disagreement where Latin America isn't quite sure whether they want a trade deal with Europe at all. Now it's more conditions being imposed by European farmers worried about being flooded with cheap Latin American beef and those kind of issues. So I think it's problems that are much more solvable than the ones they've had in the past. So they didn't quite manage to get a trade deal this year. They're going to keep pushing for it, and we can expect more negotiations on this coming up soon. Just a few days ago, on December 21st, the EU and Mexico, they completed their seventh round of trade negotiations. They've had a whole bunch of these different rounds of trade talks over the course of this year. And again, this is another similar situation where the EU Trade Commissioner said, we've made a lot of progress. We are very close to a deal, but not there yet. There's still, they said, some additional work to be done at the beginning of the year, but they're very close to a deal with Mexico. And one of the big reasons why suddenly these deals are starting to fall into place is Donald Trump. Mm. It is the U.S. First of all, the U.S. has NAFTA, the North American free trade area that includes Mexico. Mm-hmm. Mexico is now getting worried that NAFTA would be canceled or watered down in some fashion.
Right. President Trump has said,
doesn't seem likely. Sorry.
Yes. President Trump has talked about renegotiating NAFTA in order to give the U.S. better terms. So I could see how that would be a big motivation for Mexico to be looking for alternative trade partners.
Exactly. They want to hedge their bets. Now, it would require a ton of trade from Europe if they were going to replace the United States for Mexico.
Right.
But still, more trade is much better than none, even if it would take quite a while for the EU to equal that kind of trade. So they've had a number of practical there've been a number of practical steps towards this just in the last year or so where they've been trying to reach out to Europe in this way. And then for some of the nations in Mercosur and several other nations in Latin America, they were going to be part of this Trans-Pacific partnership trade deal that Donald Trump cancelled as one of his very first acts as president right at the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. And so they were kind of getting ready to be in this trade deal with the United States. And then when that backed out, that kind of sparked much more interest in alternatives. And they've been looking to Europe and they've been looking to China. So I think that's why they've started to make the progress that they have struggled to make in years past, even if they've struggled to get the final details. But I mean, Japan, just going back to the Japanese deal, that got finished a lot quicker than people were expecting. I think people were saying, you know, we think that this is 2-3 years away realistically, back when they announced the initial deal earlier in the year. So these things are moving more quickly than ever before. And it's that kind of the trade policies of Donald Trump are a big part of the reason for that.
You mentioned China there, and we've spoken on the show before about how both Russia and China are steadily increasing their trade and influence and even their military presence in some ways in Latin America. Could you talk a little bit about how that activity from Moscow and Beijing could influence Europe's relationship with Latin America?
Yeah, it is an interesting one to watch. I think the European Chinese and the whole European Asian dynamic is a fascinating one, because on the one hand they are allies in some ways. You know, they would like to see America's influence in this region and a whole load of other regions weakened, and so you see them working together. But at the same time, they're also competitors, and you see them also competing for some of these same types of deals around the world. So you have this kind of uneasy truce sometimes kind of this love-hate relationship. You see it with this One Belt, One Road economic project, where on the one hand, both nations really like the idea of having better connected overland trade routes between them and more trade. But on the other hand, both of them kind of want to be the main driver of that relationship. So I think in Latin America, there's a similar dynamic. They're cooperating when it comes to trying to reduce America's influence, but at the same time, they're competitors as well. I think China initially has some advantages over Europe, just because Europe at the moment is so inefficient and bureaucratic, and it's got all of these problems, whereas China has a strong man and they're able to move much more quickly. But as you get Europe changing, having those changes that we're expecting, as they become more of a super state with a strong man in charge, they've got more levers of power within Latin America than China has. They've got these cultural links going back hundreds and hundreds of years. I remember doing a piece a few years ago where you look at the Latin American militaries and they're just about all made up of secondhand European equipment. And that just shows kind of that's a great symbol of the relationship right there. There's even that language benefit, where the main languages in Latin America are Spanish and Portuguese. So I think we can expect, just even from that standpoint, Europe to come out on top in that area. But I think right now, while the US is on top, they're both working together in a lot of respects.
What is the significance of this European Latin American trade activity in terms of Bible prophecy? And what literature would you point listeners to if they'd like more information about this trend?
Yeah, it is of huge significance. I mean, Latin America is, people have called it America's backyard. It's something that is really closely connected to America. I mean, the drugs trade is just one very practical example of that. You've got billions and billions of tons of drugs coming up into America from that region. They're just geographically connected. And anything that happens there is going to affect the United States. And that's why for basically a couple of hundred years, America's best political thinkers have been saying, well, you know, they have the Monroe Doctrine. They say, well, we need to keep these other major powers out of Latin America. If we're going to stay safe, we need these powers out of Latin America. And you can see why. There's a few occasions where Germany had plans to gain a foothold in Latin America on a step towards an invasion of the United States. And even Napoleon had plans along those lines. So just geographically and from that logic, it's very important for America to remain the dominant power there. But both Mr. Obama and Mr. Trump have really turned away from that. And you're seeing China and Europe, they've been coming into Latin America more and more for the past couple of decades. But in, say, the last 5 years, it's really accelerated. So that history alone tells you that this is dangerous. And then Bible prophecy talks very specifically about competition between Europe and China and America, and it initially takes the form of trade competition. And it even goes so far as having a blockade, a siege, where America is cut off. And the best way to cut America off from world trade involves cutting, it involves Latin America. So much of America's trade comes through the Caribbean. It comes through places like the Panama Canal. And that's another story from recently that I didn't really talk too much about, where you had Germany working on building essentially a rail Panama Canal through Central America. So it's something that, that the Bible says they're going to use this region to besiege America, to cut America off economically and use that to bring them down. Now, to read more about this, I would really, the April 2017 edition of the Trumpet magazine is a great place to start. We have a couple of articles in there, and we'll include those in the show notes. One is called Trade Wars Have Begun, and the other, Latin America, Frontline of Trade War. And you put those two together, they give you the Bible, what the Bible prophecies about trade war, and then going into more some of the specifics involving what the Bible prophesies about Europe and China and Latin America.
Well, thanks very much for sharing your insight on that, Richard. Well, terrorism has struck Russia once again. There was an attack this week at a public location in St. Petersburg. And to tell us about this and what its implications are for Russian President Vladimir Putin, we'll go to Anthony Chibodidwe. And Anthony, maybe you could just begin by bringing us up to speed on the details of the attack itself, when and where it happened and what the casualties were.
The attack occurred on Wednesday at a supermarket in St. Petersburg. And CCTV footage shows a man entering the supermarket with a backpack, which he then places in a locker that's used by customers. And shortly thereafter, the explosion went off. Now, Russian authorities believe that this was a homemade bomb that had about 7 ounces of TNT and packed with pieces of metal. Thankfully, no one was killed in the attack, but 13 people were wounded. And I believe half are still in hospital right now.
And who exactly are the terrorists here? Has the attack been claimed by any of the prominent terror groups?
None of the prominent terror groups have claimed responsibility for this attack. But Russian media outlets who have analyzed the video have described the suspect as being of non-Slavic appearance. Mm. I think the implication, or one of the implications there, is that he's probably of Middle Eastern descent. And yes, already they are talking about it as a terrorist attack.
Vladimir Putin is no stranger to confronting terrorists. Could you talk a little bit about his history with terrorism and just how that has shaped his leadership?
Yeah, let me just say that the main reason why we thought that this story is significant is because of Russia's, especially Vladimir Putin's, experience with terrorism and how he has reacted to it. This is not necessarily the worst terrorist attack in the world. It's not the worst terrorist attack in Russia. But terrorism does affect people. It does affect leaders like Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of terrorist attacks in the early 2000s, and there's one that I just wanted to... bring to the attention of our readers, and that was the one in 2004, instigated by Chechen terrorists, and they killed over 300 people, and half of them were school children. So that was a big attack, and back then, an angry Vladimir Putin made this acknowledgement. He said this, quote, "We demonstrated weakness, and the weak are beaten." You could almost say that Vladimir Putin's dictatorship began after the terrorist attack, because he implemented reforms that included abolishing elections of mayors and governors. So that's how he reacted to that terrorist attack. And we can see him reacting in a similar way even after this attack. Like I said, it's not the biggest attack, but it is significant. Happened in St. Petersburg, his hometown. It's Russia's second largest city. And the day after the attack, Vladimir Putin was in Moscow at a ceremony that was giving awards to officers who had just returned from Syria, Russian officers who had just returned from Syria, and he was awarding them with the medals. And he asked this question. He asked, quote, what would have happened if those thousands of terrorists which we were fighting against in Syria had come back to us, trained and armed. In other words, he was trying to say that we did the right thing in Syria and we shouldn't stop right now. So we can expect Russia to continue. We can expect Russia, Vladimir Putin, to increase his strong use of force. Here's another quote that he said. He ordered the Russian security agents who might feel threatened by any terror suspects. He said this: act decisively. Do not take any prisoners and liquidate the bandits on the spot. Now, those are strong words. And Russia, like I said, has a history of using terrorist attacks to justify its strong use of force and its grip on power.
So these kinds of attacks give him a stronger and a tighter grip on power. Would you be able to put Vladimir Putin's increasing power in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
On March 18, 2018, Putin will be running for his fourth term as president. And that election date, by the way, happens to be the fourth anniversary of Russia's annexation of Crimea. So it's a big deal, and Vladimir Putin is bound to use a lot of these acts like this, like what happened in St. Petersburg. He's going to use it to justify his power, to show his people that he is fighting for Russia and he needs to continue fighting for Russia, and that Russia needs to be in Syria, in the Middle East, essentially all over the place. And the Bible talks about a prince of Russia in these times we're living in. And no one fits the bill more than Vladimir Putin. Attacks like this one in St. Petersburg and a handful of others in recent weeks and months will only strengthen his hold on power. If our listeners want to learn more about this prophesied Prince of Russia, we have a book by that title, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Okay, and we'll be sure to have a link to The Prophesied Prince of Russia, written by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, in the show notes for today's episode. Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG, and most of the stories that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they will be up there soon if they're not yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first, we'll cover one more story showing that religious freedom in America is under attack. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this past Thursday, they had an important court ruling in Oregon where the Oregon Court of Appeals upheld an earlier ruling fining two Christian bakers $135,000 for refusing to make a cake for a homosexual wedding ceremony. Now, this has been a case we've been following for some time, and I guess just to remind listeners of kind of the details of the lead-up to this, this actually started all the way back on January 17th, 2013, when Aaron and Melissa Klein, they ran a bakery in Oregon. They had a lesbian couple come in and ask them to make a cake for their upcoming wedding. And they turned down their request due to religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. And then the couple took them to court, suing them for 88 symptoms of mental anguish, including like doubt, surprise, uncertainty, dislike of going to work. Mm-hmm. And I guess won it. And actually, the first case didn't go to a court. It was actually the Oregon Bureau of Labor imposed this $135,000 fine on the Kleins. Which they've been fighting. They took it to a regular federal court, lost that ruling. Now they've taken it to an appellate court and lost that ruling. So it looks like they're paying the $135,000. But it does just put in context, too, that this is really becoming a big debate in America. Actually, the Supreme Court's getting ready to rule on a similar case in Colorado next year to decide that if pretty much the same thing, a Colorado baker who refused to make a cake for a homosexual couple on religious grounds. The Supreme Court's going to rule in on whether that's going to hold up, which will have some bearing on this case in Oregon as well.
Could you talk a little bit about this trend in terms of how it connects to Bible prophecy?
Right. And actually, we have an article in the January 2017 edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet entitled "What Will Happen to Religious Freedom," which I'd recommend for more context. We'll put it in the show notes. But it goes through a prophecy in Matthew 24 where the disciples come to Christ and they ask him for, well, what's going to be a sign of your second coming and the end of this age? And he said, well, take heed that no man deceive you. Many will come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And then a verse or so later it says, and they shall deliver you up to be afflicted, and they shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for not my name's sake. Mm-hmm. So it's talking about two Christians in every nation on earth being persecuted for their beliefs. And now, obviously, already many nations on earth, probably even most nations on earth, would not allow you to keep the true doctrines of the Bible without some persecution. The United States and Western Europe have kind of been the exception to that. But, like I said, this is an ironclad prophecy from Jesus Christ himself, the greatest of the prophets, that this religious freedom is something that's going to go away. And actually, it's kind of an interesting thing is that even the fact that it's going to go away indicates that it had to come in the first place. Hmm. So even the religious freedom we have in America today, in a way, was prophesied just due to the fact that the loss of it is going to be a sign of the end time. And I'm not sure how this Supreme Court ruling is going to come down, but we know for sure in the long term that things like this are going to be increasing in every nation around the world.
It almost suggests that the new religion in America is progressivism. And just this kind of redefining marriage and things like that. What literature would you recommend to listeners who would like to better understand the prophetic significance of America's decline?
I'd say actually for the Lion Has Roared booklet is one of our pieces of literature that we don't advertise on this program as often, but it does actually contain some definitely information about a time period that's related to what I'm talking about called the famine of the word, a time when it will even be hard to find God's, a short time, mm-hmm. but even be hard to find God's truth because it's being so suppressed around the world. So if you're just really interested in this period of like religious persecution and even this short time period before Christ's second turn where you can't find the truth like you can find it now, I would recommend that Lion Has Roared booklet by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury.
Well, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about Hamas's efforts to take over the West Bank, signs of biological weapons in North Korea, proof that anti-Semitism in Germany lives on, and how America's drug crisis could be leading to martial law. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and some very worrying reports have emerged this week showing that the Hamas terrorist group is positioning itself to take control over the West Bank. And apparently Hamas has the full support of Iran in this pursuit. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Brent Noctegal.
There was a really important meeting that took place behind closed doors last Sunday, and this was where the Shin Bet chief or the head of Israel's security agency basically briefed the influential Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee of the government. And it was meant to be kept secret, I guess, but it the reports or what he said was leaked to the public. And basically the main thrust of his message, what they're seeing in the security agency is that Hamas has kind of moved in its main objectives from not just dominating the Gaza Strip, where they are in charge, and not just firing weapons upon or missiles or rockets upon Israel from the Gaza Strip or trying to provoke war from the Gaza Strip. He actually said that they are trying to position themselves to take over the West Bank, the other Palestinian territory, basically east on the eastern side of Jerusalem, and then to the north and to the south. And so this is really interesting. A couple of quotes from that, or at least from the leaked report, said that, quote, "It is not impossible that Ismail Haniyeh or Yahya Sinwar, he's the leader of the Hamas in the Gaza Strip, will take control of the West Bank. He then warned that Hamas is trying with all its strength to carry out attacks in the West Bank and to do through that to disturb the stability of the Palestinian Authority inside the West Bank." So this is really interesting. Apparently over the past year, there were about 148 Hamas cells that were broken up by the Israeli security services inside the West Bank. This isn't the Gaza Strip. This is inside the West Bank, to show that and showing that they are extremely active in that territory.
So this is one group of Palestinians, the Hamas terrorists in the Gaza Strip, fighting against another group of Palestinians, essentially trying to take control of their territory in the West Bank. Is this infighting among the Palestinians ordinary, or is this something that we've not really witnessed before?
It's not like the two Palestinian groups of Fatah and Hamas are actively fighting against one another. Rather, they're both vying to control the Palestinian populace. And right now, Hamas does govern the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, over 1 million Palestinians there. But that's a smaller territory, and there's not many population centers or Israeli population centers near that. You do have townships, of course, that are near the Gaza Strip. But as far as implementing a war on Israel, proper civilian centers, it's very difficult. The West Bank's a full different story. There's over 300,000 Israelis that live inside the West Bank. And of course, the West Bank hugs right up to East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem's technically included in the West Bank. And so if they're going to harm Israel, Hamas is seeing now that they need to control the West Bank. And so they are trying to take advantage of a weakened Fatah Palestinian Authority leadership. Mahmoud Abbas has been leading the Palestinian Authority that's inside the West Bank for over a decade now. I think he had a 4 or 6 year term, but he's still there. And he was the protege or the successor from Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas. And a lot of Palestinians are disgruntled with that leadership there inside the West Bank. And so they are looking for other leadership as well. So it's not an active fight between Palestinian groups. It's more one Palestinian group trying to destabilize the situation inside the West Bank, and so that the Fatah government will fall.
Okay, I see. So the ultimate goal then for Hamas is to essentially push Fatah and Mahmoud Abbas out so that they can take full control in order to be better positioned to attack Israel or the
They would like to do this through elections. This is the main reason that elections haven't been held in the Palestinian territories for over a decade, because the last time that they were held in 2006, encouraged by the West to hold democratic elections, Hamas gets the popular vote. And so Mahmoud Abbas hasn't been so unwise as to have another election. And so barring an election, barring some type of reconciliation between the groups, Hamas has realized that the only way that it's going to gain control of the West Bank is through some type of takeover.
Could you talk a little bit about how this trend connects to Bible prophecy, and also about what literature you'd recommend to any listeners who would like to better understand the prophetic significance of this development?
Sure. So we have to view Hamas's actions in relation to its or as being led by Iran. And even as you mentioned in the introduction there, Iran, through its Quds leader, Qassem Soleimani, has expressed its vocal support for Hamas's takeover of the West Bank, because, of course, Iran does vie for control. It wants control over the Palestinian cause. It wants control over it wants well, an ability to act in the affairs of Israel and in Jerusalem. And so it uses Hamas as its proxy to do that. And we've been talking about that for a long time, over a decade. There's a really important article that people can go back and read. It's entitled "Iran Conquered Lebanon, Now What?" And it was written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, and the managing editor of the Trumpet, Joel Hilliker. And they talk about how Iran took over, through Hezbollah, had took over another one of its proxies, Lebanon, and how they are looking to do the same thing inside the Palestinian territories through Hamas. And if Iran is going to act on Jerusalem and inside Jerusalem affairs as it so desires, having its entity in the Gaza Strip is not enough. It has to control the West Bank. And so any movements for Hamas to do that, being backed and supported by Iran, is extremely prophetic.
Okay, and we'll be sure to have a link to that article in the show notes. So if any listeners would like to better understand that, please check that article out there. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, back in November, a soldier from North Korea defected to South Korea, and he was wounded badly in the process. He was shot several times, but he survived, and he's been recovering in a South Korean hospital. And the South Korean authorities said that as they have been helping this man to get back to health and conducting various tests on him, they found something very unusual in his bloodstream, and that was anthrax antibodies. So this suggests that this North Korean soldier was vaccinated against anthrax exposure. And it has many worried that this is basically proof that the regime of Kim Jong-un is planning to use biological weapons such as anthrax against their enemies. And then this week, to add to those fears, there were reports that North Korea may be planning to test intercontinental ballistic missiles loaded with anthrax. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Anthony Chibadidwe.
I think maybe the first question we could ask is North Korea planning to use anthrax? That's actually the title to an article that we have on our website at www.thetrumpet.com. And the answer to that question is yes. North Korea is planning to use anthrax. In your introduction, you talked about evidence of anthrax in those defectors. And some people might have questions about, okay, is North Korea's dictator, is he stable? Is he crazy? Is he suicidal? Well, there is absolutely no question about this one fact. He is an evil person. He has allegedly ordered the assassination of his half-brother earlier this year with VX, which is the most potent nerve agent known to man. That assassination was carried out in broad daylight at an international airport in Malaysia, and it seems apparent that that assassination was intended to send the message that North Korea has no qualms about killing its enemies in whatever way is expedient. Mm-hmm. So that is definitely a possibility.
So from that assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother with illegal chemical warfare agent, VX, I think it was, nerve agent, from that assassination, it's clear that he would have no qualms about using chemical or biological weapons, which makes this a very alarming development. Could you place this in the context of what Bible prophecy says about end-time warfare?
The U.S. government has released a report saying that the North is pursuing chemical and biological weapons that could be deliverable by a missile. And that's warfare involving nations, and that is possible. And the Bible does talk about not necessarily North Korea launching these weapons. We don't know about that from the Bible, but the Bible does talk about the effects of weapons like that being used. And that makes it very significant. That makes everything that's happening in North Korea very significant. It spends billions or millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on these weapons and starves its people. So we know that it has the will to use it. And the Bible does talk about the effects of those weapons. If our listeners want to learn more about this, I recommend that they request our free booklet, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. all of the stories that we're discussing today and the booklets, such as the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse that Anthony just mentioned there, are published on thetrumpet.com. So please visit there to check these stories and booklets out, and also to subscribe to our free print edition and our free email news briefs. For our next story, we'll talk about a worrying trend in Germany, which involves some common ground that German Muslims have found with German right-wing extremists. These two factions don't see eye to eye on much at all, but when it comes to hating Jews, they are apparently in full agreement. To talk about this, we'll head back over to Richard Palmer in our European office.
Yeah, this is a really important trend to watch. I think in some ways, one of the most controversial forecasts that we make at the Trumpet, based on Bible prophecy, is that Germany is a danger to the state of Israel. More than that, that Germany will eventually attack the state of Israel. And I think if you take a very quick surface look at Germany, people look at that and come away and say, well, that just doesn't seem right. Angela Merkel, she'll go to Israel, she'll go to the Holocaust Memorial and pay her regards, pay her respects for the dead, and she's always very apologetic for Germany's past there. And it's very easy to look at that and say, everything is fine. Israel is fine to trust Germany, just with a very surface look. Mm-hmm. Now, Bible prophecy tells us that's absolutely not the case. And a deeper look at Germany also tells us that that is not the case. And Joshua Michels has an article up on our website, what do Muslims and German right-wing extremists have in common, their hatred for Jews, where he looks at this trend in a fair bit of depth, where he goes and brings out even how the German news media, many in the German news media themselves, are starting to draw attention to this trend and saying, look, we still have a problem here. And it's something actually even since he wrote this, there have been more news stories, again, with the German press having a look at themselves, saying, we don't like to admit it, but we do have an anti-Semitism problem within Germany. And he's actually looking at writing that up and even bringing us a longer, more comprehensive article, because it is such an important subject. So you had a day of rage in Germany on December 8th, and the immediate trigger for that was Donald Trump's moving of the announcement of moving of the embassy to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those were Arabs and Muslims in that protest. But a lot of German politicians have painted this as just a Muslim problem within Germany. Germany had massive migrations from Turkey, for example, going back decades. Just about all of the Muslim world has extreme problems with anti-Semitism. And so they try and pass it off as, well, the Germans are fine, but this is a Muslim problem in our midst. Mm. But he goes through and talks about how it's not the case. He quotes several experts. He quotes some headlines from, I think it was Spiegel Online, for example. They had the headline, Palestinians die during knife attack on Israelis. I mean, over here, the BBC does exactly the same thing, where it just, the headline even gives you a completely distorted picture of what is happening. And so he really makes a strong case, using a lot of these different bits of evidence, that this is a real problem. I remember even working on a few years ago, I think it was Pew did a whole bunch of statistics, and you look at, say, instances in anti-Semitism all around, and it did studied in several different countries. And on Europe, it is dramatically more than it is, say, in Britain and America, more than we that live in these countries tend to encounter. And you look at the stats, and those stats do make clear that this is much more than just a Muslim problem. So I'd really urge our readers to go and look at that article, What Do Muslims and the German Right-Wing Extremists Have in Common, Their Hatred for Jews. And as I said, keep an eye out for that longer article as well, because this is an important story. You can look at scriptures. He talks about Psalm 83 in that article, Hosea chapter 5. There are some very clear warnings for Israel not to trust Germany, and instead, really, the only place for their solutions is to trust it in God. And even this weekend's Key of David on the Hezekiah Bulla talks about what can happen when a nation does trust in God. So that article is a good place to start. That will point you to another one: Can Israel Trust Germany? To help you delve into just this important news story.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. Our final story today is about how America's drug addiction and its drug crisis is leading to myriad serious problems both in the U.S. and in Mexico. Andrew Miller has written an article about this, which is up at thetrumpet.com right now. It's called America's Drug Crisis Leading to Martial Law? Andrew, what can you tell us about this drug crisis and where it's leading?
Right. Well, Mexico right now is suffering its bloodiest year on record. They started keeping record in 1997, and it's definitely worse now than it's been at any point since then. Already over 23,000 people have been murdered this year, and the statistics for December aren't in yet. But even without the statistics for December, that's definitely more than their previous worst year in 2011.
Wow.
About 70 people being murdered a day. And they're really, most security analysts are attributing to this fact that the cartels, they used to be really dominated by the Sinaloa cartel, are starting to break up and fragment and fight with each other. And that fighting is even spreading into the United States in big cities like Chicago and Baltimore as local street gangs associated with different cartels in Mexico fight with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So Mexico's understandably kind of freaking out right now. And the Senate just passed a law. The president hasn't signed it yet, but it looks like he's definitely going to, allowing the military to get involved in domestic law enforcement. Normally the military has been reserved for fighting external threats, and
right.
The police fight cartels and internal threats. Well, now you've got the military, even without previous congressional approval, Congress has kind of approved ahead of pre-approved the president whenever he sees fit to send military troops in to take out cartels in the region, which is almost, it's like a precursor to out-and-out martial law when a president can just send in military soldiers to enforce the law at will like that.
And then the United States is also giving quite a lot of funding to Mexican authorities to help them combat, you know, the cartels. How much is the U.S. spending, and do you think that that's a justified use of American resources?
Well, they definitely give about $10 million to the Mexican military, about $240 million to Mexican law enforcement,
mm-hmm.
and about another $240 million worth of military hardware to United States police forces to deal with the gangs here. That's not the U.S. using the military. We're not legally allowed to use our military and domestic law enforcement, but we do kind of sidestep that by just giving all the weapons and tanks and drones that the military has to domestic police. Now, as far as whether it's a justified expense, that's actually a good question, because it's normally that's kind of concerning to see all this militarization of police forces, martial law, things like that. But on the other hand, it's really concerning to have drug cartels and other criminals murdering 23,000 people a year. And that really kind of gets back to the point of this article is that there is no freedom without law, or the fact that if people don't willingly submit themselves to law and order, then you either have anarchy or someone has to forcibly make you submit, and freedom disappears. And so you've kind of got this horrible dichotomy between do we just let the nation go fall into crime and anarchy, or do we actually use like dictatorial, even military measures to try to stabilize this? The only way you could not do either is if people police their own lives, police their own morality, don't get involved in these problems like drug addiction and crime and things like that.
Could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just tell listeners where they might go to get more information on this topic?
Right. Well, the main prophecy we're looking at here is a prophecy in Ezekiel, where God actually, he describes a situation exactly like this, where he says, because people won't submit themselves willingly to obey his laws, that crime and anarchy and burning and pestilence is going to escalate to a point to where even like a third of the nation, I mean, it's hard to wrap your mind around that number, will die. That's a prophecy in Ezekiel 5, where it talks about a third of the nation dying in pestilence, which is just a way to describe this rioting and looting that comes from this type of of lawlessness. And so, and we have, I guess, a couple books we can put in the show notes. One is Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, which gives a clear picture of where this trend is taking America. But then we also have No Freedom Without Law, which is probably more of bringing this down to a personal level, showing that when you're involved in things like alcoholism and drug addiction, you become enslaved to those things, and it has a ripple effects that destroy freedom.
Yes, and we will have links to those booklets in the show notes, as well as a link to Andrew's article, America's Drug Crisis Leading to Martial Law. So please come to thetrumpet.com and check those out. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about all these stories that we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out several times each week. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Brent Noctegal, and Richard Palmer.
Thanks for having
Good
me.
To be here. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Jesse Hester. And we'll leave you today with some words from the former British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, who died on this day back in 1986. He said, "History is apt to judge harshly those who sacrifice tomorrow for today." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.